ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A lot of people have been throwing the B word around lately.
The entire AI industry is a bubble primed to burst.
In July 2025, tech companies' share of the S&P 500 reached its highest level since the dot-com bubble 25 years ago, and that really didn't go very well.
The NASDAQ index falling more than 200 points.
So what happened last time, and what can it tell us about what's going on with AI today? I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we give you the backstories behind the big stories.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
Government is always formed in the sensible centre, but our Liberal Party reflects a range of views.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Welcome to the Party Room. I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney.
And I'm Sarah Ferguson, host of 7:30, also joining you here in the Sydney studio. Fran filling in for PK while she undertakes some secret mission.
A secret mission. Dun-dun-dun-dun. But it's great to have you. It's great to be in the same studio. PK and I, we're always miles apart, so it's nice to have a buddy.
A buddy across the great bar that we've got between us here.
Look, the summer break is so close, I can almost smell it. Well, for some of us anyway, lucky ones. But I have to say, politics is showing no sign of slowing, Sarah. Just ask the Communications Minister, Annika Wells. You know, this was going to be her big week with the start of the under-16 social media ban. This is where all the trouble started for Annika Wells, because she caught those flights to the UN to spruik the ban world first. But the flights cost nearly $100,000 and, you know, that started the whole thing. She's been in the bunker really ever since, fending off questions about various expenses claims. It's gone on, and it still goes on.
I absolutely accept that those figures prompt a gut reaction in people. I honestly accept that. And I agree with everybody that parliamentarians' entitlements should be scrutinised. I've said that from the get-go. I've always said that.
And it's a busy week. Like I said, the opposition is fast-forwarding its plans for tougher immigration rules in a bid to fend off One Nation. We haven't seen the plan yet, but it's coming. One Nation really has hit a bit of a purple patch. It's growing support. I think it's tripled, actually, in the latest polls since the election. And Barnaby Joyce, of course, has jumped ship to One Nation. He's thrown his Akubra hat in the ring with Pauline Hanson. No surprise, but huge disappointment to his friends and colleagues, Sarah.
It is a lot. It's a long list. Was there ever a time in politics when things actually did fade a little earlier than this? But anyway, since it's a lot, let's get going with the entitlements, because obviously everyone has been talking and talking and writing about it. Phil Currie, political editor of the Australian Financial Review. Phil, welcome to the Party Room.
Thanks, Sarah. Hi, Fran.
Hey, Phil. Great to have you back.
Now, Phil, because you've been doing this for a wee while, you must have seen more than your fair share of expenses scandals over the years. How does this one compare?
Oh, it's up there. it never ceases to surprise me that people still do this, abuse the spirit of these entitlements, because it always ends the same. I think it's about every 4 or 5 years you get a blow up like this. You get one example, as you mentioned in your intro, about the trip to New York by Annika Wells, and then suddenly everyone starts looking at everything else, and all this stuff comes out, and it just spreads like a contagion. Normally it ends one of two ways. Either, you know, the Prime Minister of the day announces, you know, that the minister's going to pay back some money and they're going to review the rules, or they pull out some stuff on the other mob, and then the prospect of mutually assured destruction sort of calms it all down. But neither of those has sort of happened in this case. So it's sort of
yet.
It's still not yet. So it's still running.
Quick question, Phil. You just used the word abuse of the system in relation to
the
New York flights. Tell me why that one, as opposed to the ones where people are bringing their families, why is that an abuse?
Well, it's a bit different. I mean, it's not an entitlement. It's just the cost of doing business.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, no, that's not the entitlement, like family reunions and travel allowances and stuff like that. I just thought it was ludicrous to pay that much money to go. I was at that event in New York. We travelled there with the PM. We knew that Annika Wells had to delay. She was meant to fly over with us on the PM's jet and the rest of the entourage, but she had to delay it because of Optus. And I was at that thing at the UN, and I remember I observed to my friend Tom McElroy at The Guardian, and I said, I said, I wonder why she bothered coming, because the Optus thing was running really hot at home and it was not resolved. And I thought, must have cost a fortune to get her here at the last minute. I said something like that to Tom, and she's going to get fried for leaving the Optus thing, both of which were astute observations as it turned out. But just common sense. I mean, no one would have minded had they said, look, the minister can't make it because she's got this problem at home in her communications portfolio. And then when they saw the price of those airfares, someone should have said something, or a red flag should have got up. It wasn't an abuse per se, but it turned out as it turned out for a reason. I mean, 100K to go to go to New York, and she didn't have a big role. Like, she just emceed it.
That was a bad call, but that actually wasn't her call. Like,
no.
The minister is not the one who signs off on the cost of the ticket, but the others, Phil, that we've since rolled out since then, these are her judgments, the family reunion flights, you know, the decision, you know, to bring your husband over with you because you've got tickets to the Formula One in a box, or you've got tickets to the Australian Open, you know. Family entitlements rules are there, and they're made not by the – it's important to note they're not made by the politicians. They're made by an independent agency of the parliament called IPEA, the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Committee. They're there because politicians, in acknowledgement, politicians spend a long time away from family. But you've got to be judicious about it, right? So, you know, maybe you think about it, and – if you want to bring your husband to the corporate box at the Formula One, maybe pay for that one or some of those yourself. If you have to go to Orange for a weekend for a stakeholders conference because you're the minister, then maybe you can claim that one because it happens to be your kid's birthday or something. Like, think about community standards.
Look at what the older MPs who don't get their names in the paper when this turns up.
Exactly.
Look how they treat them, right? Go on. It's usually the young ones. And we should... It's not just Annika here.
It's not
really
just Annika, and that's interesting.
Sarah Hanson Young flying her husband back and forth to Canberra, you know, busy lobbyist. They have a house here, using the family reunion for that. It's pretty whiffy, you know, Don Farrell and his wife sort of sauntering around the country.
Phil, can I just jump in as the devil's advocate just for a moment? Of course, Annika Wells is the sports minister, so the things she goes to are fun. Are we just against this because they're appearing to have fun? It's not just the flight, but it's because it's for something fun. Are we anti-fun?
Well, we are a little
bit. No, we're not anti-fun. I don't think we're anti-fun.
Look, there is an element of that, but you'd have to remember, and I do want to sort of elaborate here a bit. I mean, Annika really wanted the sports portfolio. She held it in the last term, and she really asked for it when Albanese redid his front bench after the election. So she willingly wants to do the job because she does enjoy the fun element of it. I'd point you to a column in our paper today by Tracy Holmes. I mean, she does have a bit of a reputation for leaning into the fun side of being sports minister. So
what
it's not
does
like
that
she,
mean?
Well, she likes going to lots of things and getting tickets for lots of things.
And
she's nicknamed the Minister for Scarves. She or Tracksuit Annie, as she's known as well. And so she sort of enjoys that side of the job. I don't want to sort of beat up on her too much on that. But look, I've been speaking to a lot of people in Labor the last couple of days, and everyone thinks the family reunion stuff is really important. You know, they say if you want to have young parents, predominantly women in parliament, then you need it.
There are a lot of people who complain that politics has been only for people who are older, over 60, old blokes, but not for people who represent all different parts of our community. And it's got to be possible to be an MP, to be able to travel, to be able to work right across the country and also be a parent. And I know from my own experience, I find it really hard being away from family, and it's a big part of the job. So I'm not asking for sympathy.
Politics has one of the highest rates of family breakup and divorce and, you know, kids going weird, you know, out of any profession because they're away so long. But what people are worried about, as one minister said to me, is the piss take, right? That's the word this minister used. And it's not just sort of, you know, pushing the envelope on family reunion, but it's the non-family reunion entitlements, like, you know, Wells going to Adelaide for a friend's birthday party and sort of rigging up a meeting with a state minister on a Saturday afternoon to justify it, you know, to justify the trip.
Yeah, but Phil, they've all done that,
they
all have done that forever.
Yeah, but the older ones don't do it, right?
Oh, some of them do it. What about the Prime Minister having a minister's meeting ahead of a Labor fundraiser,
exactly,
you know, an hour-long meeting? I mean, that is age old.
And that's called the piss take, right? No one believes that's fair dinkum.
I think think the piss take is closer to, you know, the old adage used to be the pub test. We've got one young listener, Zach, who suggested perhaps we could change the does it pass the pub test adage to does it pass the group chat test. And I think that's great advice. Yeah. Good one, Zach.
Yeah,
That'll steer you right.
Zach. I've been trying to figure out what the right phrase was.
I mean, I don't begrudge any minister, like if Annika Wells' husband wants to go to the Formula One, that's fantastic. She's got tickets. That's great. But some of those things you can pay for yourself because parliamentarians get paid fairly well, you know. And I think the test is, and the reason, it's not that we're anti-fun, Sarah. I think it's that, you know, the Australian population is looking and a lot of people go, well, I would love to go to the Formula One and the Australian Open and all these things, the AFL Grand Finals, you know, how lucky are you? And you are lucky. So you just got to recognise that and take that into account so that you are really on the side of the angels when it comes to any test. I think that's
it goes to a mindset, right? And, you know, I was talking to someone who this minister and this minister's spouse, are like half the cabinet was offered tickets to Lady Gaga on Friday night. And they had sort of thought, no, it's just not worth the reputation for a couple of hundred bucks, right? Even though they probably, you know, there's no harm in taking them and declaring them. And that's the, you know, I always default to Jay Weatherill when he was Premier of South Australia, when, you know, there was all this outrage because the politicians got a pay rise and he was getting beat up at a press conference. And he said, look, if the public had their way, they wouldn't pay us. Right? So I'm going to take this pay rise.
That's it.
I think Albanese runs the same line, doesn't
he? That's gold,
so,
Phil.
So that's the sort of mindset that the politicians deal with. That's the starting mindset the politicians deal with the public. And that was before a cost of living crisis.
All right. Well, let's have a broader look at it, Phil and Fran, because we are talking a lot about Annika Wells and she has been bearing the brunt of the criticism. Mm. But, of course, it has emerged once this got going that, as Fran said, they've been doing it for a long time and that whatever you say, Phil, it's not just the young people. I know what you're talking about, but we know it isn't just them. So what have we found out this week? We found out that family reunion travel for federal MPs and senators has cost us, taxpayers, more than $1 million last financial year. Don Farrell turns out to be top
Labor
of the
Trade
league.
Minister.
Not a millennial, Phil. Top of the family travel tally, over 41,000 in the past 12 months. I think that included a dinner in Uluru, didn't it?
Yes.
Then we've got Fatima Payman. Of course, Fatima Payman's from Western Australia, so you need to take
Flights
a careful look at it.
Flights are expensive.
And then remember this gentleman who came third in the league table, a certain Mr. Peter Dutton.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't been a federal MP since May,
true.
Obviously, so he scored quite highly. Actually, Annika Wells ranks number 34, ring a bell, for family reunion spending. She's 18 on the list of Comcar use and 17 for international travel. So she's a long way down the list.
That's a long way down the list. I was struck by that figure, Phil, because I watched Insiders. You're on the Insiders Couch this week. And the suggestion came up that this revelation about Annika Wells' spending was orchestrated by someone inside Labor. I mean, according to that list, Sarah said she's 34th for family reunion spending, so she's not the worst offender. Can you tell us any more about if this was a hit job?
Oh, no, because I don't know. Samantha Maiden said that to me sitting next on the couch. No, I don't know. There are a few people. It's politics, right? So there's always a lot of envy, and especially when someone like Annika, who's on the an up-and-comer, you know, and so there's a few people, you know, sort of quite a little bit of schadenfreude going on inside some sections of Labor. But I have no direct evidence that, you know, any of her colleagues have FOI'd this stuff. I mean, it's all there on the public record, as we know, because people have been trawling through everyone else's records. But I just go back to the basic point. Whether you're talking about Annika Wells or Don Farrell or anyone else, you just got to be smart about the way you use this stuff, right? Because when it comes out, it comes out. This is where, you know, we got to be careful, you know, the disconnect that I see is starting to really grow between this government and the punters. And it's not just over this, it's over transparency in general, whether it's the FOI laws or whatever else. As Barbara Pocock said last week, this is a government of gesture rather than action, real action. And this, to me, is sort of feeding into that bigger picture that this government is starting to look arrogant and detached. And and you can argue the toss on these things about family reunion and, you know, should have gone to Threadbow or should, you know, Don taking his wife to Uluru or whatever. But if you just actually sit back and look at it from the perspective of people, and people are doing it really hard, And they, you know, and you know, the political establishment is sitting here arguing the toss on this sort of stuff about whether the Grand Prix
or the rules are out of the rules. Yeah.
Seriously, let's just ground ourselves a bit here. It's really bad out there. It is really tough out there. You know, and inflation's back on the rise again, and that's why the smart politicians, you know, they get that, right? But there's some people who just think, oh, well, it's in the rules. I'm going to use the rules to the full extent of the rule, and that's where my radar is, and that's where I think this government has to be careful.
And I think, Phil, that's why Anthony Albanese wanted to go out in this year with something that wasn't in that category at all. It was a real, you know, people's vote, if you like, on the social media ban, the under 16 social media ban.
This is world leading. This is Australia showing enough is enough. And the world, including through, I note, some leading media global organisations who are here, just to confirm, is watching.
He's aware that parents around the country are really agitated about kids' social media use, and he really wanted to push this through. This is what they were supposed to be talking about at the end of the year, so that people went off in the summer holidays feeling really good about this government taking action, listening to them, being tapped into their concerns. And that ban, which came in, we're recording this Thursday morning, came in yesterday, it's been completely overshadowed by the entitlement issue. You know, Annika Wells, the minister who's meant to have responsibility for this, you know, was virtually in witness protection for most of the week. It was the eSafety Commissioner, Julian Mangrant, who had to do most of the heavy lifting. But it has been brought in. There's teething problems already. We've all seen them. This will be tricky, but potentially, is this still a politically winning pursuit, and will this still rescue the government, if you like, from this the bin fire of this week of and the arrogance and detachment that you talked about? Yeah, what do you think?
I think it'll outlast the events this week, because we'll get bored of this entitlement stuff pretty soon, because we'll run out of things and we'll just move on. The social media ban is going to take a long time to work, and I like it that the government is open about that. They're not trying to declare success straight away. I mean, as the parent of a teenager affected by this, and my daughter, she doesn't like it, right? when Albanese said in Perth the other week he did that 6-7 routine for the kids.
Oh, yeah.
He said, oh, he's just trying to suck up to us for banning TikTok. That was a reaction.
But, actually, Keir Starmer did the same thing. They're all at it.
Yeah.
But you know, kids who are sort of having their accounts shut down, they're like the sort of unlucky ones, if you like. It's really about, as Annika Wells and others say, it's about the ones who've yet to get a mobile phone, the kids yet to reach 12 or 13. It's about saving them from getting on this drip in the first place. You know, as a parent, I'm glad they're doing it. You know, I can see exactly why they're doing it. Trying to prise the phone out of a kid's hand is just impossible.
Quick question, Phil. Yeah. Can I just jump in with a quick one? I noticed Anthony Albanese yesterday was careful, deliberate to include Peter Dutton.
I do want to acknowledge as well Peter Dutton on a day like today. This legislation passed the Parliament last year with bipartisan support. Peter Dutton's someone who has always cared about
was that
the
just
impact of
decency,
harm
or was that sharing Australia the responsibility for what unfolds?
It's trying to stare down the opposition's criticism of it,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I think a bit of both. It was actually Peter Dutton who first proposed this.
It was
in his budget address and reply.
Yeah.
It may not have been this ban exactly as it's been enacted, but it was, you know, I think it was under 16s or something, and Dutton spoke about the evils of social media on kids, so, and he had teenagers at the time, so that's right. But also, I think, to your point, Sarah, that, you know, there was sort of rock solid by partisanship around this up until a couple of weeks ago, and then the opposition started making noises about revelling in its ability to fail.
Yes, I think we heard the Shadow Communications Minister, I think she was on Raph Epstein's program in Melbourne, supportive of the ban itself because it's hard to come out in fierce opposition to that, but she found a way to criticise the rollout.
The ban itself and protecting kids has my full support. The rollout by the government does not. I have been questioning their ineffectiveness of including platforms. We now are hearing that.
Yeah, that's a narrow goat track, isn't it?
Yeah, which it's a bit mean-spirited given this is you know, it's going to be hard enough to make this succeed given you're up against, A, the might of the tech giants and the guile of kids who know how to get around everything. Mm.
Makes Julian Mingrant a very interesting character, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, yes, indeed. And when I interviewed her this week on the Radio National Hour, and it was a terrific interview because she made it clear that, you know, yes, it's not going to be perfect. It's the first one. The world is watching, and indicated that over the next, is it going to be weeks, months, years, they're going to amend this. You know, I got the sense that already, you know, there's people who think that they'll change the date, the age of the ban and things like that. But, you know, just to finish it off here, I think there will be ongoing focus on whether it works. And I did a straw poll around the office with the parents, and Phil, you've just added to it. And, you know, there's 12-year-olds and 14-year-olds texting each other saying, Albanese hasn't got me yet. You know, there's kids playing I'm Still Standing on TikTok.
Yeah. Yes. But Julian Mingrant, were she here, she would say they knew that was going to happen. Yeah.
Yes.
There are going to be teething problems. There are going to be hiccups. We're expecting that. We're expecting that there'll be a different story every day about a child here who got around this and that and blah, blah, blah. We are taking a longer term view. This is not, you know.
Look, while this has been playing out, the entitlements thing in particular, the opposition's been largely sort of leaving the field to for Labor to deal with it. But, Phil, we are apparently going to get the coalition's immigration policy probably this week. Susan Lee made that pivot to immigration very quickly after they announced their net zero decision. And I wondered at the time, was this to get out in front of the right-wing competitors in her own party room or to get out in front of One Nation? Because the polls since the election have shown One Nation's vote tripling since May at the expense of the coalition's vote largely. So, Phil, what are we going to get from the coalition, and why is she sort of moving full steam ahead with this so quickly?
Well, it's both France to get ahead of the right wing and One Nation because they're sort of they're combined. Look, it's the same reason they had to rush forward the decision on net zero. You know, the original plan was to announce that policy sometime in next year, first half of next year. But, you know, the Nationals moved first, and then with One Nation surging in the polls and then pressure on Susan Lee's leadership, you had no choice. And it's the exact same thing.
She looked like a lame duck then.
Well, yeah, everyone's got a view except us. So, and the main driver of One Nation's popularity, Fran, is migration. It's not net zero, but everything is sort of flowing from that. You know, it's been blamed on housing and everything else, and the cost of living and things like that. So they've got to get out on the front foot on migration. But again, it's the same problem between the moderates and the conservatives. Mm. You know, how far do you go? So I think it'll be next week now. They were going to release it this week, but you know, they're having a brief moment of joy watching the government squirm for a change after a pretty horrible few weeks. So they've decided to push it into next week, as I understand.
And is Susan Lee, Phil, Fram, what do you think? Is Susan Lee going to be able to resist the language that the moderates were so keen for her not to use, not to hammer home,
like mass
particularly
migration.
That term, yes, mass migration?
She won't use that term.
No, but the moderates, I've spoken to some moderates who said they're pretty happy with it in terms of it doesn't single out races and, you know, and it avoids that sort of language. But at the same time, it's fairly forward leaning. Use that term again.
What do we know about what's in it?
Well, they're not going to have, one of the criticisms of the government is the government's refused to set a long-term population or migration target, even though they said they would. The Liberals aren't going to do that, but it's going to sort of work backwards, Fran. The migration target will be based on capacity to take people. So if there's not enough housing or not enough roads or whatever else, it'll be calibrated backwards from capacity constraints.
How do you work that out? I remember governments talking about that in the past.
100%. And the trouble is it's all going to be principles, but they are going to, the net overseas migration is the one, that's the scary number, right? That's tourists and people coming and going, Australians included. That's still at about 310,000 a year. So they're talking about getting that down on a permanent basis to somewhere between 160 and 220. I don't know what number.
It is coming down already, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's coming down. Hasn't the government got a broad goal of 260 or something?
260, yeah.
Yeah, but the Libs are talking about 160 to 220. Right?
Can I just raise a part of this that could get ugly, and this is the focusing on removal of illegals.
Yes.
So both One Nation and the Liberals are clearly talking about what to do about the large number of people who shouldn't be here, who are ready
by
for
illegals, women undocumented, right?
Although their visas have expired.
Yeah.
So we had a story the other day. There's about 100,000 people who came as students or temporary workers, and then they just stay when their visa. Then they try to stay, and they can
and
stay
they use
for years.
Every appeal mechanism they can, and it lasts for years.
They lodge asylum appeals and try to get other visas and stuff. And they're clearly gaming the system in a lot of cases. And they're hard to remove, right?
But how does that land? Because we are in the context, obviously, those incredible scenes in the United States. The reason why that number is so high, Phil, as you just said, it's because it is incredibly hard to remove them. Yeah. So what are the mechanisms you're going to introduce?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But they would somehow try and limit their rights of appeal. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see when they release this thing. But there is a caveat that it's only going to be broadly principles with detail to come later. But they'll be able to talk tough on principle. But yeah, you'd sort of think if it was easier to do this, it would have been done by now. But there's something like 100,000 people, and the fastest growing cohort of these, what they call overstayers or legacy cases are foreign students. So you come over and you do, it's not so much people come over and do degrees and things, and go back. It's just people come over and do some shonky course as a way of getting in, and then you just stay.
We're obviously going to talk about One Nation in a minute, but there's just an interesting Redbridge poll that was in the Financial Review in November that found that One Nation was more trusted than Labour or the Coalition to deal with the influx of migrants.
And that dovetails with another poll this week, the Resolve poll, which found that I was really struck by this figure, 2 in 3 Australians say what they want immigration paused until housing supply catches up with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real issue. Yeah, that was our poll. That same poll had One Nation's primary vote at 18%, which is almost three times what they received at the federal election, and the Liberals' primary vote falling to a record low of 24, and nearly all of it going to One Nation. So you can sort of see why, they're responding the way they are. And, the government is really worried about it too, but they're almost silent on the issue. They just don't talk about it. Like when Tony Burke a few months ago announced the new he was late in doing it. They meant to do it before the start of the financial year. He announced it after he put out a 3-paragraph statement about how many, the new permanent intake for next year.
Well, a day they're talking about immigration is a day they are losing, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's so right.
Everyone's aware that it's a huge problem out there. I mean, people are very sensitive about it, and there's a general feeling there's too many people coming into the country.
Yeah, and look at us. We're talking about One Nation a lot at the moment. Barnaby Joyce made the jump this week. We've all been waiting.
Working with people such as Pauline, I think I have a fellow traveller, and I have great respect for the work that Pauline has done. She has driven the political agenda.
I feel like there should be a very significant sound effect at this moment.
Yeah, exactly. Is it a splash? What is it?
Like Zebedee's spring or something.
Is it a belly flop?
Who remembers Zebedee amongst our listeners?
I do.
He's now officially sitting in the lower house as a One Nation MP when the House resumes. He's the first One Nation member in the House of Reps since 1998, apparently. And this move, I didn't know this, Phil, I'm sure you're all over this, gave One Nation official party status, which incidentally gives Pauline Hanson a huge pay rise because she's now party leader. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I wrote that last week or this week. Yeah, 100 grand. But I do believe Pauline. She said that's not why I did it, because she's not the sort of person who's motivated like that. But it is probably more go to the motive of Barnaby, because there is a rough plan here. And, given the nature of the individuals involved, it may not come to pass. But that at the next election, Hanson will run again, but she'll be 74 by then. She'll probably retire sometimes afterwards and hand her vacancy, her spot, to another Queenslander, and then Barnaby becomes leader. And then he gets, because they will have a minimum of 5 senators then, if he wins the New South Wales spot, or 5 MPs, which is what you need for party status, then he gets the leadership role and the extra salary. And all his friends, or now former friends in the Nationals, believe his motive all the way along is to get a leadership position and the extra income, which he denies. But it's just in the case of what happened this week with Joyce defecting to One Nation, they now have 4 senators and 1 in the House of Reps, so that gives them minor party status. And so Pauline gets 42.5% loading on the $239,000 backbench salary she gets. So, but that's just...
Wow.
But I'm not accusing of being driven by
that. No. I'm not either. I was just struck by that reality.
it is a
Sarah, you interviewed Barnaby this week on 7:30. I spoke to Tony B Barry, I was speaking to Tony Barry from Redbridge earlier this week, and he reckons this move of Barnaby Joyce to One Nation will lend legitimacy to the One Nation brand. I wonder what you think about it and what you picked up when you interviewed Barnaby Joyce.
In answer to that question, first of all, I must say I am torn between the lending of legitimacy and the it's going to go into a steaming heap. There was some interesting writing coming out of New England over the last few days with people saying, don't be ridiculous, we're not stupid, we know what One Nation is. He cannot take whatever qualities he had with him and think that we're going to accept them in this wearing this new cape. But on the bigger question, speaking to Joyce this week, I asked him whether he saw himself as part of the global movement, particularly obviously comparing him to the One Nation to the Reform Party in the UK and him as Nigel Farage.
Oh, yeah.
He tried to deflect the Nigel Farage comment by saying he was better looking than Nigel Farage.
I think I'm far better looking, but no, I don't.
There is no way in which I'm going to comment on that.
But I won't.
Again, this is a serious question. Is this move to do with the Australian-ness of Barnaby Joyce and Pauline Hanson, that it is related, sui generis, related to Australian politics, or are they connected to a global populist movement that includes Farage in the UK, Meloni in Italy, other countries in Europe, and obviously the great gigantic MAGA movement in the United States now.
Which Pauline Hanson is very plugged into.
You know, so it is a huge tailwind, if you like, of semi-legitimacy, of political legitimacy. Certainly within political science, it's legitimacy. Whether it actually is reflected in what happens here, I don't know, but it's clearly, obviously, in their minds that they are part of something bigger, and Barnaby obviously sees the value for him in that.
Yeah, and Phil, just finally on this, I mean, we have compulsory voting, and I think that's a big difference to those countries. But
Barnaby, in answer to that question, said yes, but politics here is changing very fast. You know, be careful. You're trapped in that notion of compulsory victim voting. He said it's what made us slow to the global movement, the global populist movement, but it won't exclude us.
Phil?
Well, it doesn't exclude them, but it probably means compulsory preferential voting means they could never be a party of government as such. But the plan is, and he stated this openly, is to get a controlling hunk of the Senate. So you can still, you can still wield an enormous amount of influence. And look at the influence. At the influence they've been wielding already. We've just been talking about the Liberal Party having to jump to their tune on immigration and energy. Mm. So just the spectre of, erosion has caused the Liberal Party to behave as it has in the last month. So you don't necessarily need to be a party of government, but you can still exert influence, and that's clearly Joyce's MO on all this.
I don't know. I don't know how people will respond to Joyce, who has not thought. Let me just put this to you, Phil, on the questions of racial vilification that One Nation has indulged in for many, many years now, including up until very recently. He doesn't have a good argument for how he feels about that. It doesn't feel like it's his thing.
I assume it's not his thing. He's not a race guy.
Look how he came out in support of the Bilawilla family.
That's right. But this is the thing. If you talk to sort of strategists and even in Labor and the Libs, they actually think, let's just very quickly, Pauline Hanson, is One Nation, right? It's an eponymous party, but she realises she can't be there forever. And that's why they've brought in Joyce, because he's the succession plan, because it needs a big personality. Now, about 3 weeks ago, they quietly changed their name from Pauline Hanson's One Nation to One Nation. So they've got rid of the Pauline Hanson. This is part of the transition. And, what surprised everyone the other week with the burqa was that party was starting to get traction and it was starting to get mainstream support. And then she goes and does a race stunt like that. And that's the sort of thing that scares people back to the Liberal Party. It's a bit like when the Greens got too far out there last time and they scared voters back to Labor. So Barnaby won't do that. And if you talk to strategists, they say if he takes over and she's gone and the party's still relevant, they could become, because he won't do those stupid race stunts or those nasty race stunts. And so that they could actually consolidate. And they could actually become more formidable in 3 or 4 years with him at the helm, if it all holds together. There's a lot of ifs between now and then.
There's a lot of ifs, as former Labor leader Mark Latham told you when he's been through this. He jumped to One Nation, as he said to you, Phil, it's all going to end in tears. I was struck by comments from another former, long-time former Nationals MP and friend of Barnaby Joyce, Ron Boswell, long-time crusader against Pauline Hanson and One Nation. In the Oz this week, he described One Nation as shouters and stunt performers, and then he went biblical and he said, quote, like the prodigal son, Barnaby has taken his inheritance of political experience and wandered off, and we all know how that story ends. Now, that ended with the prodigal son being welcomed home, so I wonder if the Nats would be so open-armed. Phil, as always, it's great to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having
me. See you, Phil. Enjoy the summer in your tinny.
We'll see you down there, Sarah. Okay.
Questions without notice. Are there any questions?
Members on my right.
Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. Well,
then I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
Well, the bells are ringing, and that means it's time for question time. And this week's question comes from Liam.
Hi, Fran and PK. Liam here. I work as a public servant, and I've been thinking about the government's social media ban for under 16s. To me, it sits in the category of these big public safety interventions and reminds me of policies like John Howard's gun reforms that were seen as contentious at the time but are now viewed as long-term successes by the majority of people. If this social media ban is going to be looked back on in 20, 30 years as a similar defining moment for Australia, what does the government need to do to get that right in terms of the policy, design and the communication? And what are the political or practical risks over the coming years that could stop it from becoming kind of a legacy achievement for the country?
That is a very good question. I want to first pay tribute to my 7:30 colleague, Jacob Grieber, who said yesterday when the ban came in, a whole generation of libertarians have just been born. Thanks to the social media ban, they'll rise up against the notion of government. Of course, failure, as Liam is asking, failure is always a risk. Now, Anthony Albanese tried to say yesterday that it was already a success. The fact that we were talking about social media, we were talking about the dangers, made it a success already. I mean, sure, he would say that. It's, of course, not strictly true because it has to work for it to be... For this to have been a successful day yesterday, the government needs this to stick. I want to listen to Julian Mangrant about this because she is the safety commissioner who designed this. She's interesting because she wanted a slightly different model than the one the government went with. She wanted one that was a little more, you know, graded in terms of who you went after in terms of harm, because she knows who the big bad players are. The government chose to go with, if you like, a unitary system, a single ban or delay that captures all those big 10 companies for now at the same time. So that is, in a sense, risky. She thought it was slightly harder to explain to the public, but she has power now. And this is the thing, Liam, I think that will decide whether or not this works. She has the power. She will go now to the social media companies, ask them to demonstrate what they're doing, whether they are complying with the ban. However, here is a big thing that could stop it being the success, Liam, that you're talking about. And that is, she says the social media companies might purposefully kind of crash their age verification systems, i.e. make them not work very well. I don't mean crash them on a single day.
Well, they're not
day,
working but, yet, according but, to the Maestro poll.
But she will, what she warns of, that they will actually purposefully make them fail the age verification and then come back to the government and say, nice try, nice idea, it doesn't work. But she says, we know that they're going to try and do that. We're watching.
Yeah, and I mentioned before the interview I did on the Radio National Hour with the Safety Commissioner. She was really signalling that they're going to keep monitoring this. They're actually going to measure. They're going to go into each of these companies and demand this data. And they've got a whole huge compliance unit now doing this. And they're going to calibrate it so that, you know, we will see changes, as you say, suggested Liam, to the policy design and to the communication around it too. But I do think it's interesting, Liam, you've made a good point here about comparing this to the gun ban, John Howard's gun reforms, because, yes, they were very contentious. But mostly, who they were contentious with, and I think this is a real similarity with this social media ban, they were contentious with some of the key users for sure, you know, and a lot of those are constituents of the National Party particularly, but they were contentious with the gun lobby. And what we've got here is the gun lobby, and now we've got the big tech lobby, and that's who the government is fighting here, as Sarah suggested. So
gigantic.
And they are gigantic, and they are politically influential, as was the gun lobby back then, but these are different times, and it's a different kind of lobbying power, and it's global, and the world is watching this. But, you know, I think it's a good comparison you make. The risks are, as Sarah suggests, that they just can't get big tech to play ball. And, you know, we know they're usually at least five steps ahead. So
at least if we remain not cynical while we watch what happens next, so that we can test what happens without saying, nah, it'll never work.
I'll just read you one thing. The Guardian today has a whole list of comments from parents, and one of them was, our son can no longer access his apps. It's already had a profound effect. This morning he said, Mum, do you want to do something with me after school today, like putt-putt or something else to get all together?
Well, I think that's much more realistic than Anthony Albanese yesterday saying on 702, the kids are going to, they can learn instruments, so we're going to have a whole lot of bassoon players that emerge from the summer.
Well, if they bring in a lot more subsidies for sport and things like extracurricular activities in school, like bassoons, that could be a good thing, and that could help along.
It would be a good thing.
We love your questions. Keep sending them in. We're especially fond of the voice notes, which you can email to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Now, remember to follow Politics Now on the ABC Listen app so you never miss one of these marvellous episodes.
That's right. That's it from us this week. See you, Sarah.
See you, Fran.